Side 5, The Autobiography of Malcolm X, continuing on page 152. The prison psychologist interviewed me, and he got called every filthy name I could think of, and the prison chaplain got called worse. My first letter, I remember, was from my religious brother Filbert in Detroit, telling me his Holiness Church was going to pray for me. I scrawled him a reply I'm ashamed to think of today. Ella was my first visitor. I remember seeing her catch herself, then try to smile at me, now in the faded dungarees stenciled with my number. Neither of us could find much to say until I wished she hadn't come at all. The guards with guns watched about 50 convicts and visitors. I've heard scores of new prisoners swearing back in their cells that when free, their first act would be to waylay those visiting room guards. Hatred often focused on them. I first got high in Charlestown on nutmeg. My cellmate was among at least 100 nutmeg men who, for money or cigarettes, bought from kitchen worker inmates penny matchboxes full of stolen nutmeg. I grabbed a box as though it were a pound of heavy drugs. Stirred into a glass of cold water, a penny matchbox full of nutmeg had the kick of 3 or 4 reefers. With some money sent by Ella, I was finally able to buy stuff for better highs from guards in the prison. I got reefers, Nembutal, and Benzedrine. Smuggling to prisoners was the guard's sideline. Every prison's inmates know that's how guards make most of their living. I served a total of 7 years in prison. Now, when I try to separate that first year plus that I spent at Charlestown, it runs all together in a memory of nutmeg and the other semi-drugs, of cursing guards, throwing things out of my cell, balking in the lines, dropping my tray in the dining hall, refusing to answer my number, claiming I forgot it, and things like that. I preferred the solitary that this behavior brought me. I would pace for hours like a caged leopard, viciously cursing aloud to myself. And my favorite targets were the Bible and God. But there was a legal limit to how much time one could be kept in solitary. Eventually, the men in the cell block had a name for me, Satan, because of my anti-religious attitude. The first man I met in prison who made any positive impression on me whatever was a fellow inmate, Bimby. I met him in 1947 at Charlestown. He was a light, kind of red-complexioned Negro, as I was, about my height, and he had freckles. Bimby, an old-time burglar, had been in many prisons. In the license plate shop where our gang worked, he operated the machine that stamped out the numbers. I was along the conveyor belt where the numbers were painted. Bimby was the first Negro convict I'd known who didn't respond to, "What you know, Daddy?" Often, after we'd done our day's license plate quota, we would sit around, perhaps 15 of us, and listen to Bimby. Normally, white prisoners wouldn't think of listening to Negro prisoners' opinions on anything, but guards even would wander over close to hear Bimby on any subject. He would have a cluster of people riveted, often on odd subjects you never would think of. He would prove to us, dipping into the science of human behavior, that the only difference between us and outside people was that we had been caught. He liked to talk about historical events and figures. When he talked about the history of Concord, where I was to be transferred later, you would have thought he was hired by the Chamber of Commerce, and I wasn't the first inmate who had never heard of Thoreau until Bimby expounded upon him. Bimby was known as the library's best customer. What fascinated me with him most of all was that he was the first man I had ever seen command total respect with his words. Bimby seldom said much to me. He was gruff to individuals, but I sensed he liked me. What made me seek his friendship was when I heard him discuss religion. I considered myself beyond atheism. I was Satan. But Bimby put the atheist philosophy in a framework, so to speak. That ended my vicious cursing attacks. My approach sounded so weak alongside his, and he never used a foul word. Out of the blue one day, Bimby told me flatly, as was his way, that I had some brains, if I'd used them. I'd wanted his friendship, not that kind of advice. I might have cursed another convict, but nobody cursed Bimby. He told me I should take advantage of the prison correspondence courses and the library. When I had finished the 8th grade back in Mason, Michigan, that was the last time I thought of studying anything that didn't have some hustle purpose. And the streets had erased everything I'd ever learned in school. I didn't know a verb from a house. My sister Hilda had written a suggestion that, if possible in prison, I should study English and penmanship. She'd barely been able to read a couple of picture postcards I'd sent her when I was selling reefers on the road. So, feeling I had time on my hands, I did begin a correspondence course in English. When the mimeographed listings of available books passed from cell to cell, I would put my number next to titles that appealed to me which weren't already taken. Through the correspondence exercises and lessons, some of the mechanics of grammar gradually began to come back to me. After about a year, I guess, I could write a decent and legible letter. About then, too, influenced by having heard Bimby often explain word derivations, I quietly started another correspondence course. In Latin. Under Bimby's tutelage, too, I'd got myself some little cell block swindles going. For packs of cigarettes, I beat just about anyone at Domino's. I always had several cartons of cigarettes in my cell. They were, in prison, nearly as valuable a medium of exchange as money. I booked cigarette and money bets on fights and ball games. I'll never forget the prison sensation created that day in April 1947 when Jackie Robinson was brought up to play with the Brooklyn Dodgers. Jackie Robinson had then his most fanatic fan in me. When he played, my ear was glued to the radio, and no game ended without my refiguring his average up through his last turn at bat. One day in 1948, after I'd been transferred to Concord Prison, my brother Filbert, who was forever joining something, wrote me this time that he had discovered the natural religion for the black man. He belonged now, he said, to something called the Nation of Islam. He said I should pray to Allah for deliverance. I wrote Filbert a letter which, although in improved English, was worse than my earlier reply to his news that I was being prayed for by His Holiness Church. When a letter from Reginald arrived, I never dreamed of associating the two letters, although I knew that Reginald had been spending a lot of time with Wilfred, Hilda, and Filbert in Detroit. Reginald's letter was newsy, and also it contained this instruction. Malcolm, don't eat any more pork, and don't smoke any more cigarettes. I'll show you how to get out of prison. My automatic response was to think he'd come upon some way I could work a hype on the penal authorities. I went to sleep, and woke up, trying to figure what kind of a hype it could be. Something psychological, such as my act with the New York Draft Board? Could I, after going without pork and smoking no cigarettes for a while, claim some physical trouble that could bring about my release? Get out of prison. The words hung in the air around me. I wanted out so badly. I wanted in the worst way to consult with Bimby about it. But something big, instinct said. You spilled to nobody. Quitting cigarettes wasn't going to be too difficult. I'd been conditioned by days in solitary without cigarettes. Whatever this chance was, I wasn't going to fluff it. After I read that letter, I finished the pack I then had open. I haven't smoked another cigarette to this day since 1948. It was about 3 or 4 days later when pork was served for the noon meal. I wasn't even thinking about pork when I took my seat at the long table. Sit, grab, gobble, stand, file out. That was the Emily Post in prison eating. When the meat platter was passed to me, I didn't even know what the meat was. Usually you couldn't tell anyway. But it was suddenly as though, "Don't eat any more pork," flashed on a screen before me. I hesitated with the platter in midair. Then I passed it along to the inmate waiting next to me. He began serving himself. Abruptly he stopped. I remember him turning, looking surprised at me. I said to him, "I don't eat pork." The platter then kept on down the table. It was the funniest thing, the reaction, and the way that it spread. In prison, where so little breaks the monotonous routine, the smallest thing causes a commotion of talk. It was being mentioned all over the cell block by night that Satan didn't eat pork. It made me very proud in some odd way. One of the universal images of the Negro, in prison and out, was that he couldn't do without pork. It made me feel good to see that my not eating it had especially startled the white convicts. Later I would learn, when I had read and studied Islam a good deal, that, unconsciously, my first pre-Islamic submission had been manifested. I had experienced, for the first time, the Muslim teaching, "If you will take one step toward Allah, Allah will take two steps toward you." My brothers and sisters in Detroit and Chicago had all become converted to what they were being taught was the natural religion for the black man, of which Filbert had written to me. They all prayed for me to become converted while I was in prison. But after Filbert reported my vicious reply, they discussed what was the best thing to do. They decided that Reginald, the latest convert, the one to whom I felt closest, would best know how to approach me, since he knew me so well in the street life. Independently of all this, my sister Ella had been steadily working to get me transferred to the Norfolk, Massachusetts prison colony, which was an experimental rehabilitation jail. In other prisons, convicts often said that if you had the right money or connections, you could get transferred to this colony whose penal policy sounded almost too good to be true. Somehow, Ella's efforts on my behalf were successful in late 1948, and I was transferred to Norfolk. The colony was, comparatively, a heaven in many respects. It had flushing toilets, there were no bars, only walls. And within the walls, you had far more freedom. There was plenty of fresh air to breathe. It was not in a city. There were 24 house units, 50 men living in each unit, if memory serves me correctly. This would mean that the colony had a total of around 1,200 inmates. Each house had three floors, and, greatest blessing of all, each inmate had his own room. About 15% of the inmates were Negroes, distributed about 5 to 9 Negroes in each house. Norfolk Prison Colony represented the most enlightened form of prison that I'd ever heard of. In place of the atmosphere of malicious gossip, perversion, grafting, hateful guards, there was more relative culture, as culture is interpreted in prisons. A high percentage of the Norfolk Prison Colony inmates went in for intellectual things, group discussions, debates, and such. Instructors for the educational rehabilitation programs came from Harvard, Boston University, and other educational institutions in the area. The visiting rules, far more lenient than other prisons, permitted visitors almost every day and allowed them to stay 2 hours. You had your choice of sitting alongside your visitor or facing each other. Norfolk Prison Colony's library was one of its outstanding features. A millionaire named Parkhurst had willed his library there. He'd probably been interested in the rehabilitation program. History and religions were his special interests. Thousands of his books were on the shelves, and in the back were boxes and crates full, for which there wasn't space on the shelves. At Norfolk, we could actually go into the library, with permission, walk up and down the shelves, pick books. There were hundreds of old volumes, some of them probably quite rare. I read aimlessly until I learned to read selectively, with a purpose. I hadn't heard from Reginald in a good while after I got to Norfolk Prison Colony, but I'd come in there not smoking cigarettes or eating pork when it was served. That caused a bit of eyebrow raising. Then a letter from Reginald telling me when he was coming to see me. By the time he came, I was really keyed up to hear the hype he was going to explain. Reginald knew how my street hustler mind operated. That's why his approach was so effective. He'd always dressed well, and now when he came to visit was carefully groomed. I was aching with wanting the no pork and cigarettes riddle answered, but he talked about the family, what was happening in Detroit, Harlem the last time he was there. I have never pushed anyone to tell me anything before he's ready. The offhand way Reginald talked and acted made me know that something big was coming. He said finally, as though it had just happened to come into his mind, "Malcolm, if a man knew every imaginable thing that there is to know, who would he be?" Back in Harlem, he'd often liked to get at something through this kind of indirection. It had often irritated me because my way had always been direct. I looked at him. "Well, he would have to be some kind of a god," Reginald said. "There's a man who knows everything." I asked, "Who's that?" "God is a man," Reginald said. "His real name is Allah." Allah. That word came back to me from Filbert's letter. It was my first hint of any connection. But Reginald went on. He said that God had 360 degrees of knowledge. He said the 360 degrees represented the sum total of knowledge. To say I was confused is an understatement. I don't have to remind you of the background against which I sat hearing my brother Reginald talk like this. I just listened, knowing he was taking his time in putting me onto something. And if somebody is trying to put you onto something, you need to listen. The devil has only 33 degrees of knowledge, known as masonry, Reginald said. I can so specifically remember the exact phrases, since later I was going to teach them so many times to others. The devil uses his masonry to rule other people. He told me that this God had come to America, and that he made himself known to a man named Elijah. A black man, just like us. This God had let Elijah know, Reginald said, that the devil's time was up. I didn't know what to think. I just listened. The devil is also a man, Reginald said. What do you mean? With a slight movement of his head, Reginald indicated some white inmates and their visitors talking as we were across the room. Them, he said. The white man is the devil. He told me that all whites knew they were devils, especially Masons. I never will forget. My mind was involuntarily flashing across the entire spectrum of white people I'd ever known, and for some reason it stopped upon Jaime, the Jew, who had been so good to me. Reginald, a couple of times, had gone out with me to that Long Island bootlegging operation to buy and bottle up the bootleg liquor for Jaime. I said, without any exception? Without any exception. What about Jaime? What is it if I let you make $500 to let me make $10,000? After Reginald left, I thought. I couldn't make of it head or tail or middle. The white people I'd known marched before my mind's eye. From the start of my life, the state white people always in our house after the other whites I didn't know had killed my father. The white people who kept calling my mother crazy to her face and before me and my brothers and sisters until she finally was taken off by white people to the Kalamazoo Asylum. The white judge and others who had split up the children, the Swirlins, the other whites around Mason. White youngsters I was in school there with, and the teachers. The one who told me in the eighth grade to be a carpenter because thinking of being a lawyer was foolish for a Negro. My head swam with the parading faces of white people, the ones in Boston, in the white-only dances at the Roseland Ballroom where I shined their shoes, at the Parker House where I took their dirty plates back to the kitchen, the railroad crewmen and passengers, Sophia, the whites in New York City, the cops, the white criminals I dealt with, the whites who piled into the Negro speakeasies for a taste of Negro soul, the white women who wanted Negro men, the men I'd steered to the black specialty sex they wanted. The fence back in Boston, and his ex-con representative, Boston cops, Sophia's husband's friend and her husband, whom I'd never seen but knew so much about, Sophia's sister, the Jew jeweler who'd helped trap me, the social workers, the Middlesex County court people, the judge who gave me 10 years, the prisoners I'd known, the guards, and the officials. A celebrity among the Norfolk prison colony inmates was a rich, older fellow, a paralytic called John. He had killed his baby, one of those mercy killings. He was a proud, big-shot type, always reminding everyone that he was a 33rd-degree Mason, and what powers Masons had, that only Masons ever had been U.S. presidents, that Masons in distress could secretly signal to judges and other Masons in powerful positions. I kept thinking about what Reginald had said. I wanted to test it with John. He worked in a soft job in the prison school. I went over there. John, I said, how many degrees in a circle? He said, 360. I drew a square. How many degrees in that? He said, 360. I asked him, was 360 degrees then the maximum of degrees in anything? He said, yes. I said, well, why is it that Masons go only to 33 degrees? He had no satisfactory answer. But for me, the answer was that Masonry, actually, is only 33 degrees of the religion of Islam, which is the full projection forever denied to Masons, although they know it exists. Reginald, when he came to visit me again in a few days, could gauge from my attitude the effect that his talking had had upon me. He seemed very pleased. Then, very seriously, he talked for 2 solid hours about the devil white man and the brainwashed black man. When Reginald left, he left me rocking with some of the first serious thoughts I'd ever had in my life. That the white man was fast losing his power to oppress and exploit the dark world. That the dark world was starting to rise to rule the world again, as it had before. That the white man's world was on the way down. It was on the way out. You don't even know who you are, Reginald had said. You don't even know. The white devil has hidden it from you. That you are of a race of people of ancient civilizations, and riches and gold and kings. You don't even know your true family name. You wouldn't recognize your true language if you heard it. You have been cut off by the devil white man from all true knowledge of your own kind. You've been a victim of the evil of the devil white man ever since he murdered and raped and stole you from your native land in the seeds of your forefathers. I began to receive at least 2 letters every day from my brothers and sisters in Detroit. My oldest brother, Wilfred, wrote, and his first wife, Bertha, the mother of his 2 children. Since her death, Wilfred has met and married his present wife, Ruth. Philbert wrote, and my sister Hilda, and Reginald visited, staying in Boston a while before he went back to Detroit, where he had been the most recent of them to be converted. They were all Muslims, followers of a man they described to me as the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, a small, gentle man whom they sometimes referred to as the Messenger of Allah. He was, they said, a black man like us. He had been born in America on a farm in Georgia. He had moved with his family to Detroit, and there had met a Mr. Wallace D. Fard, who he claimed was God in person. Mr. Wallace D. Fard had given to Elijah Muhammad Allah's message for the black people who were the lost, found nation of Islam here in this wilderness of North America. All of them urged me to accept the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Reginald explained that pork was not eaten by those who worshipped in the religion of Islam, and not smoking cigarettes was a rule of the followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, because they did not take injurious things such as narcotics, tobacco, or liquor into their bodies. Over and over, I read and heard, the key to a Muslim is submission, the attunement of one toward Allah, and what they termed the true knowledge of the black man that was possessed by the followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was given shape for me in their lengthy letters, sometimes containing printed literature. The true knowledge, reconstructed much more briefly than I received it, was that history had been whitened in the white man's history books, and that the black man had been brainwashed for hundreds of years. Original man was black, in the continent called Africa, where the human race had emerged on the planet Earth. The black man, original man, built great empires and civilizations and cultures, while the white man was still living on all fours in caves. The devil white man, down through history, out of his devilish nature, had pillaged, murdered, raped, and exploited every race of man not white. Human history's greatest crime was the traffic in black flesh, when the devil white man went into Africa and murdered and kidnapped to bring to the West in chains, in slave ships, millions of black men, women, and children who were worked and beaten and tortured as slaves. The devil white man cut these black people off from all knowledge of their own kind and cut them off from any knowledge of their own language, religion, and past culture until the black man in America was the earth's only race of people who had absolutely no knowledge of his true identity. In one generation, the black slave women in America had been raped by the slave master white man until there had begun to emerge a homemade, handmade, brainwashed race that was no longer even of its true color, that no longer even knew its true family names. The slave master forced his family name upon this rape-mixed race, which the slave master began to call the Negro. This Negro was taught of his native Africa that it was peopled by heathen, black savages, swinging like monkeys from trees. This Negro accepted this along with every other teaching of the slave master that was designed to make him accept and obey and worship the white man. And where the religion of every other people on earth taught its believers of a God with whom they could identify, a God who at least looked like one of their own kind, the slave master injected his Christian religion into this Negro. This Negro was taught to worship an alien god having the same blonde hair, pale skin, and blue eyes as the slave master. This religion taught the Negro that black was a curse. It taught him to hate everything black, including himself. It taught him that everything white was good, to be admired, respected, and loved. It brainwashed this Negro to think he was superior if his complexion showed more of the white pollution of the slave master. This white man's Christian religion further deceived and brainwashed this Negro to always turn the other cheek and grin and scrape and bow and be humble and to sing and to pray and to take whatever was dished out by the devilish white man and to look for his pie in the sky and for his heaven in the hereafter, while right here on earth the slave master white man enjoyed his heaven. Many a time I have looked back, trying to assess just for myself my first reactions to all this. Every instinct of the ghetto jungle streets, every hustling fox and criminal wolf instinct in me, which would have scoffed at and rejected anything else, was struck numb. It was as though all of that life merely was back there, without any remaining effect or influence. I remember how, sometime later, reading the Bible in the Norfolk Prison Colony Library, I came upon, then I read, over and over, how Paul, on the road to Damascus, upon hearing the voice of Christ, was so smitten that he was knocked off his horse in a daze. I do not now, and I did not then, liken myself to Paul, but I do understand his experience. I've since learned, helping me to understand what then began to happen within me, that the truth can be quickly received, or received at all, only by the sinner who knows and admits that he's guilty of having sinned much. Stated another way, only guilt admitted accepts truth. The Bible again. The one people whom Jesus could not help were the Pharisees. They didn't feel they needed any help. The very enormity of my previous life's guilt prepared me to accept the truth. Not for weeks yet would I deal with the direct, personal application to myself as a black man of the truth. It still was like a blinding light. Reginald left Boston and went back to Detroit. I would sit in my room and stare. At the dining room table I would hardly eat, only drink the water. I nearly starved. Fellow inmates concerned and guards apprehensive asked what was wrong with me. It was suggested that I visit the doctor, and I didn't. The doctor advised, visited me. I don't know what his diagnosis was, probably that I was working on some act. I was going through the hardest thing, also the greatest thing, for any human being to do. To accept that which is already within you and around you. I learned later that my brothers and sisters in Detroit put together the money for my sister Hilda to come and visit me. She told me that when the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was in Detroit, he would stay as a guest in my brother Wilfred's home, which was on McKay Street. Hilda kept urging me to write to Mr. Muhammad. He understood what it was to be in the white man's prison, she said, because he himself had not long before gotten out of the federal prison at Milan, Michigan, where he had served 5 years for evading the draft. Hilda said that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad came to Detroit to reorganize his Temple No. 1, which had become disorganized during his prison time. But he lived in Chicago, where he was organizing and building his Temple No. 2. It was Hilda who said to me, "Would you like to hear how the white man came to this planet Earth?" And she told me that key lesson of Mr. Elijah Muhammad's teachings, which I later learned was the demonology that every religion has, called Jacob's history. Elijah Muhammad teaches his followers that first the moon separated from the earth, then the first humans, original man, were a black people. They founded the holy city Mecca. Among this black race were 24 wise scientists. One of the scientists, at odds with the rest, created the especially strong black tribe of Shabazz, from which America's Negroes, so-called, descend. About 6,600 years ago, when 70% of the people were satisfied and 30% were dissatisfied, among the dissatisfied was born a Mr. Jacob. He was born to create trouble, to break the peace, and to kill. His head was unusually large. When he was 4 years old, he began school. At the age of 18, Jacob had finished all of his nation's colleges and universities. He was known as the Big Head Scientist. Among many other things, he had learned how to breed races scientifically. This Big Head Scientist, Mr. Jacob, began preaching in the streets of Mecca, making such hosts of converts that the authorities, increasingly concerned, finally exiled him with 59,999 followers to the island of Patmos, described in the Bible as the island where John received the message contained in Revelations in the New Testament. Though he was a black man, Mr. Jacob, embittered toward Allah now, decided as revenge to create upon the earth a devil race, a bleached-out white race of people. From his studies, The big head scientist knew that black men contained two germs, black and brown. He knew that the brown germ stayed dormant as, being the lighter of the two germs, it was the weaker. Mr. Jacob, to upset the law of nature, conceived the idea of employing what we today know as the recessive genes structure, to separate from each other the two germs, black and brown, and then grafting the brown germ to progressively lighter, weaker stages. The humans resulting, he knew, would be, as they became lighter and weaker, progressively also more susceptible to wickedness and evil. And in this way, finally, he would achieve the intended bleached-out white race of devils. He knew that it would take him several total color change stages to get from black to white. Mr. Jacob began his work by setting up a eugenics law on the island of Patmos. Among Mr. Jacob's 59,999 all-black followers, every third or so child that was born would show some trace of brown. As these became adult, only brown and brown, or black and brown, were permitted to marry. As their children were born, Mr. Jacob's law dictated that if a black child, the attending nurse or midwife, should stick a needle into its brain and give the body to cremators, the mothers were told it had been an angel baby, which had gone to heaven to prepare a place for her. But a brown child's mother was told to take very good care of it. Others, assistants, were trained by Mr. Jacob to continue his objective. Mr. Jacob, when he died on the island at the age of 152, had left laws and rules for them to follow. According to the teachings of Mr. Elijah Muhammad, Mr. Jacob, except in his mind, never saw the bleached-out devil race that his procedures and laws and rules created. A 200-year span was needed to eliminate on the island of Patmos all of the black people until only brown people remained. The next 200 years were needed to create from the brown race the red race, with no more browns left on the island. In another 200 years, from the red race was created the yellow race. 200 years later, the white race had at last been created. On the island of Patmos was nothing but these blonde, pale-skinned, cold, blue-eyed devils. Savages, nude and shameless, hairy, like animals, they walked on all fours, and they lived in trees. 600 more years passed before this race of people returned to the mainland among the natural black people. Mr. Elijah Muhammad teaches his followers that within 6 months' time, through telling lies that set the black men fighting among each other, this devil race had turned what had been a peaceful heaven on earth into a hell torn by quarreling and fighting. But finally, the original black people recognized that their sudden trouble stemmed from this devil white race that Mr. Jacob had made. They rounded them up, put them in chains, with little aprons to cover their nakedness. This devil race was marched off across the Arabian desert to the caves of Europe. The lambskin and the cable toe used in masonry today are symbolic of how the nakedness of the white man was covered when he was chained and driven across the hot sand. Mr. Elijah Muhammad further teaches that the white devil race in Europe's caves was savage. The animals tried to kill him. He climbed trees outside his cave, made clubs, trying to protect his family from the wild beasts outside trying to get in. When this devil race had spent 2,000 years in the caves, Allah raised up Moses to civilize them and bring them out of the caves. It was written that this devil white race would rule the world for 6,000 years. The books of Moses are missing. That's why it is not known that he was in the caves. When Moses arrived, the first of these devils to accept his teachings, the first he led out, were those we call today the Jews. According to the teachings of this Jacob's history, when the Bible says, Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, that serpent is symbolic of the devil white race Moses lifted up out of the caves of Europe, teaching them civilization. It was written that after Jacob's bleached white race had ruled the world for 6,000 years, down to our time, the black original race would give birth to one whose wisdom, knowledge, and power would be infinite. It was written that some of the original black people should be brought as slaves to North America, to learn to better understand, at first hand, the white devil's true nature in modern times. Elijah Muhammad teaches that the greatest and mightiest God who appeared on the earth was Master W. D. Fard. He came from the east to the west, appearing in North America at a time when the history and the prophecy that is written was coming to realization, as the non-white people all over the world began to rise, and as the devil-white civilization, condemned by Allah, was, through its devilish nature, destroying itself. Master W. D. Fard was half black and half white. He was made in this way to enable him to be accepted by the black people in America, and to lead them, while at the same time he was enabled to move undiscovered among the white people, so that he could understand and judge the enemy of the blacks. Master W. D. Fard, in 1931, posing as a seller of silks, met in Detroit, Michigan, Elijah Muhammad. Master W. D. Fard gave to Elijah Muhammad Allah's message and Allah's divine guidance to save the lost, found nation of Islam, the so-called Negroes, here in this wilderness of North America. When my sister Hilda had finished telling me this Jacob's history, she left. I don't know if I was able to open my mouth and say goodbye. I was to learn later that Elijah Muhammad's tales, like this one of Jacob, infuriated the Muslims of the East. While at Mecca, I reminded them that it was their fault, since they themselves hadn't done enough to make real Islam known in the West. Their silence left a vacuum into which any religious faker could step and mislead our people. Chapter 11. Saved. I did write to Elijah Muhammad. He lived in Chicago at that time at 6116 South Michigan Avenue. At least 25 times I must have written that first one-page letter to him over and over. I was trying to make it both legible and understandable. I practically couldn't read my handwriting myself. It shames even to remember it. My spelling and my grammar were as bad, if not worse. Anyway, as well as I could express it, I said I'd been told about him by my brothers and sisters, and I apologized for my poor letter. Mr. Muhammad sent me a typed reply. It had an all but electrical effect upon me to see the signature of the Messenger of Allah. After he welcomed me into the true knowledge, he gave me something to think about. The black prisoner, he said, symbolized white society's crime of keeping black men oppressed and deprived and ignorant and unable to get decent jobs, turning them into criminals. He told me to have courage. He even enclosed some money for me, a $5 bill. Mr. Muhammad sends money all over the country to prison inmates who write to him, probably to this day. Regularly, my family wrote to me, "Turn to Allah. Pray to the East." The hardest test I ever faced in my life was praying. You understand? My comprehending, my believing the teachings of Mr. Muhammad had only required my mind saying to me, "That's right," or, "I never thought of that." But bending my knees to pray, that act, well, that took me a week. You know what my life had been. Picking a lock to rob someone's house was the only way my knees had ever been bent before. I had to force myself to bend my knees, and waves of shame and embarrassment would force me back up. For evil to bend its knees, admitting its guilt, to implore the forgiveness of God is the hardest thing in the world. It's easy for me to see and to say that now, but then, when I was the personification of evil, I was going through it. Again, again, I would force myself back down into the praying to Allah posture. When finally I was able to make myself stay down, I didn't know what to say to Allah. For the next years, I was the nearest thing to a hermit in the Norfolk prison colony. I've never been more busy in my life. I still marvel at how swiftly my previous life's thinking pattern slid away from me, like snow off a roof. It's as though someone else I knew of had lived by hustling and crime. I would be startled to catch myself thinking in a remote way of my earlier self as another person. The things I felt, I was pitifully unable to express in the one-page letter that went every day to Mr. Elijah Muhammad, and I wrote at least one more daily letter replying to one of my brothers and sisters. Every letter I received from them added something to my knowledge of the teachings of Mr. Muhammad. I would sit for long periods and study his photographs. I've never been one for inaction. Everything I've ever felt strongly about, I've done something about. I guess that's why, unable to do anything else, I soon began writing to people I'd known in the hustling world, such as Sammy the Pimp, John Hughes, the gambling house owner, the thief Jumpsteady, and several dope peddlers. I wrote them all about Allah and Islam and Mr. Elijah Muhammad. I had no idea where most of them lived. I addressed their letters in care of the Harlem or Roxbury bars and clubs where I'd known them. I never got a single reply. The average hustling criminal was too uneducated to write a letter. I've known many slick, sharp-looking hustlers who would have you think they had an interest in Wall Street. Privately, they would get someone else to read a letter if they received one. Besides, neither would I have replied to anyone writing me something as wild as, "The white man is the devil." What certainly went on the Harlem and Roxbury wires was that Detroit Red was going crazy in stir, or else he was trying some hype to shake up the warden's office. During the years that I stayed in the Norfolk prison colony, never did any official directly say anything to me about those letters, although, of course, they all passed through the prison censorship. I'm sure, however, they monitored what I wrote to add to the files which every state and federal prison keeps on the conversion of Negro inmates by the teachings of Mr. Elijah Muhammad. But at that time, I felt that the real reason was that the white man knew that he was the devil. Later on, I even wrote to the mayor of Boston, to the governor of Massachusetts, and to Harry S. Truman. They never answered. They probably never even saw my letters. I hand-scratched to them how the white man's society was responsible for the black man's condition in this wilderness of North America. It was because of my letters that I happened to stumble upon starting to acquire some kind of a homemade education. I became increasingly frustrated in not being able to express what I wanted to convey in letters that I wrote, especially those to Mr. Elijah Muhammad. In the street, I'd been the most articulate hustler out there. I'd commanded attention when I said something. But now trying to write simple English, I not only wasn't articulate, I wasn't even functional. How would I sound writing in slang the way I would say it? Something such as, "Look, Daddy, let me pull your coat about a cat. Elijah Muhammad." Many who today hear me somewhere in person or on television, or those who read something I've said, will think I went to school far beyond the eighth grade. This impression is due entirely to my prison studies. It had really begun back in the Charlestown prison, when Bimby first made me feel envy of his stock of knowledge. Bimby had always taken charge of any conversation he was in, and I tried to emulate him. But every book I picked up had few sentences which didn't contain anywhere from one to nearly all of the words that might as well have been in Chinese. When I just skipped those words, of course, I really ended up with little idea of what the book said. So I'd come to the Norfolk prison colony still going through only book-reading motions. Pretty soon I would have quit even these motions, unless I'd received the motivation that I did. I saw that the best thing I could do was get hold of a dictionary, to study, to learn some words. I was lucky enough to reason also that I should try to improve my penmanship. It was sad. I couldn't even write in a straight line. It was both ideas together that moved me to request a dictionary along with some tablets and pencils from the Norfolk Prison Colony School. I spent 2 days just riffling uncertainly through the dictionary's pages. I never realized so many words existed. I didn't know which words I needed to learn. Finally, just to start some kind of action, I began copying. In my slow, painstaking, ragged handwriting, I copied into my tablet everything printed on that first page, down to the punctuation marks. I believe it took me a day. Then aloud, I read back to myself everything I'd written on the tablet, over and over, aloud, to myself. I read my own handwriting. I woke up the next morning thinking about those words, immensely proud to realize that not only had I written so much at one time, but I'd written words that I never knew were in the world. Moreover, with a little effort, I also could remember what many of these words meant. I reviewed the words whose meanings I didn't remember. Funny thing, from the dictionary first page, right now, that aardvark springs to my mind. The dictionary had a picture of it, a long-tailed, long-eared, burrowing African mammal which lives off termites caught by sticking out its tongue as an anteater does for ants. I was so fascinated that I went on. I copied the dictionary's next page, and the same experience came when I studied that. With every succeeding page, I also learned of people and places and events from history. Actually, the dictionary is like a miniature encyclopedia. Finally, the dictionary's A section had filled a whole tablet, and I went on into the B's. That was the way I started copying what eventually became the entire dictionary. It went a lot faster after so much practice helped me to pick up handwriting speed. Between what I wrote in my tablet and writing letters, during the rest of my time in prison, I would guess I wrote 1,000,000 words. I suppose it was inevitable that as my word base broadened, I could for the first time pick up a book and read and now begin to understand what the book was saying. Anyone who's read a great deal can imagine the new world that opened. Let me tell you something. From then until I left that prison, in every free moment I had, if I was not reading in the library, I was reading on my bunk. You couldn't have got me out of books with a wedge. Between Mr. Muhammad's teachings, my correspondence, my visitors, usually Ella and Reginald, and my reading of books, months passed without my even thinking about being imprisoned. In fact, up to then, I never had been so truly free in my life. The Norfolk Prison Colony's library was in the school building. A variety of classes was taught there by instructors who came from such places as Harvard and Boston universities. The weekly debates between inmate teams were also held in the school building. You would be astonished to know how worked up convict debaters and audiences would get over subjects like, should babies be fed milk? Available on the prison library shelves were books on just about every general subject. Much of the big private collection that Parkhurst had willed to the prison was still in crates and boxes in the back of the library. Thousands of old books. Some of them looked ancient, covers faded, old-time parchment-looking binding. Parkhurst, I've mentioned, seemed to have been principally interested in history and religion. He had the money and the special interest to have a lot of books that you wouldn't have in general circulation. Any college library would have been lucky to get that collection. As you can imagine, especially in a prison where there was heavy emphasis on rehabilitation, an inmate was smiled upon if he demonstrated an unusually intense interest in books. There was a sizable number of well-read inmates, especially the popular debaters. Some were said by many to be practically walking encyclopedias. They were almost celebrities. No university would ask any student to devour literature as I did when this new world opened to me, of being able to read and understand. I read more in my room than in the library itself. An inmate who was known to read a lot could check out more than the permitted maximum number of books. I preferred reading in the total isolation of my own room. When I progressed to really serious reading, every night at about 10 p.m., I would be outraged with the lights out. It always seemed to catch me right in the middle of something engrossing. Fortunately, right outside my door was a corridor light that cast a glow into my room. The glow was enough to read by once my eyes adjusted to it. So when lights out came, I would sit on the floor where I could continue reading in that glow. At one-hour intervals, the night guards paced past every room. Each time I heard the approaching footsteps, I jumped into bed and feigned sleep. And as soon as the guard passed, I got back out of bed onto the floor area of that light glow, where I would read for another 58 minutes, until the guard approached again. That went on until 3 or 4 every morning. 3 or 4 hours of sleep a night was enough for me. Often in the years in the streets, I had slept less than that. The teachings of Mr. Muhammad stressed how history had been whitened. When white men had written history books, the black man simply had been left out. Mr. Muhammad couldn't have said anything that would have struck me much harder. I never forgotten how when my class, me and all of those whites, had studied 7th grade United States history back in Mason, the history of the Negro had been covered in one paragraph, and the teacher had gotten a big laugh with his joke, "Negroes' feet are so big that when they walk, they leave a hole in the ground." This is one reason why Mr. Muhammad's teaching spread so swiftly all over the United States, among all Negroes, whether or not they became followers of Mr. Muhammad. The teachings ring true to every Negro. You can hardly show me a black adult in America, or a white one for that matter, who knows from the history books anything like the truth about the black man's role. In my own case, once I heard of the glorious history of the black man, I took special pains to hunt in the library for books that would inform me on details about black history. I can remember accurately the very first set of books that really impressed me. I've since bought that set of books and have it at home for my children to read as they grow up. It's called Wonders of the World. It's full of pictures of archaeological finds, statues that depict usually non-European people. I found books like Will Durant's Story of Civilization. I read H.G. Wells' Outline of History. Souls of Black Folk by W.E.B. Du Bois gave me a glimpse into the black people's history before they came to this country. Carter G. Woodson's Negro History opened my eyes about black empires before the black slave was brought to the United States and the early Negro struggles for freedom. J. A. Rogers' three volumes of Sex and Race told about race mixing before Christ's time, about Aesop being a black man who told fables, about Egypt's pharaohs, about the great Coptic Christian empires, about Ethiopia, the earth's oldest continuous black civilization, as China is the oldest continuous civilization. Mr. Muhammad's teaching about how the white man had been created led me to Findings in Genetics by Gregor Mendel. The dictionary's G section was where I'd learned what genetics meant. I really studied this book by the Austrian monk. Reading it over and over, especially certain sections, helped me to understand that if you started with a black man, a white man could be produced. But starting with a white man, you never could produce a black man because the white chromosome is recessive. And since no one disputes that there was but one original man, the conclusion is clear. During the last year or so in the New York Times, Arnold Toynbee used the word bleached in describing the white man. His words were white, that is, bleached, human beings of North European origin. Toynbee also referred to the European geographic area as only a peninsula of Asia. He said there is no such thing as Europe, and if you look at the globe, you will see for yourself that America is only an extension of Asia. But at the same time, Toynbee is among those who have helped to bleach history. He has written that Africa was the only continent that produced no history. He won't write that again. Every day now, the truth is coming to light. I never will forget how shocked I was when I began reading about slavery's total horror. It made such an impact upon me that it later became one of my favorite subjects when I became a minister of Mr. Muhammad's. The world's most monstrous crime. The sin and the blood on the white man's hands are almost impossible to believe. Books like the one by Frederick Olmsted opened my eyes to the horrors suffered when the slave was landed in the United States. The European woman Fanny Kemble, who had married a southern white slave owner, described how human beings were degraded. Of course I read Uncle Tom's Cabin. In fact, I believe that's the only novel I've ever read since I started serious reading. Parkhurst's collection also contains some bound pamphlets of the Abolitionist Anti-Slavery Society of New England. I read descriptions of atrocities, saw those illustrations of black slave women tied up and flogged with whips, of black mothers watching their babies being dragged off, never to be seen by their mothers again, of dogs after slaves, and of the fugitive slave catchers, evil white men with whips and clubs and chains and guns. I read about the slave preacher, Nat Turner, who put the fear of God into the white slave master. Nat Turner wasn't going around preaching pie in the sky and non-violent freedom for the black man. There in Virginia, one night in 1831, Nat and seven other slaves started out at his master's home, and through the night they went from one plantation, big house, to the next, killing, until by the next morning 57 white people were dead, and Nat had about 70 slaves following him. White people, terrified for their lives, fled from their homes, locked themselves up in public buildings, hid in the woods, and some even left the state. A small army of soldiers took 2 months to catch and hang Nat Turner. Somewhere I read where Nat Turner's example is said to have inspired John Brown to invade Virginia and attack Harper's Ferry nearly 30 years later with 13 white men and 5 Negroes. I read Herodotus, the father of history, or rather I read about him. And I read the histories of various nations, which opened my eyes gradually, then wider and wider, to how the whole world's white men had indeed acted like devils, pillaging and raping and bleeding and draining the whole world's non-white people. I remember, for instance, books such as Will Durant's Story of Oriental Civilization and Mahatma Gandhi's accounts of the struggle to drive the British out of India. Book after book showed me how the white man had brought upon the world's black, brown, red, and yellow peoples every variety of the sufferings of exploitation. I saw how since the 16th century, the so-called Christian trader, white man, began to ply the seas in his lust for Asian and African empires and plunder and power. I saw how the white man never has gone among the non-white peoples bearing the cross in the true manner and spirit of Christ's teachings, meek, humble, and Christ-like. I perceived, as I read, how the collective white man had been actually nothing but a piratical opportunist who used Faustian machinations to make his own Christianity his initial wedge in criminal conquests. First, always religiously, he branded heathen and pagan labels upon ancient non-white cultures and civilizations. The stage thus set, he then turned upon his non-white victims his weapons of war. I read how, entering India, 500 million deeply religious brown people, the British white man, by 1759, through promises, trickery, and manipulations, controlled much of India through Great Britain's East India Company. The parasitical British administration kept tentacling out to half of the subcontinent. In 1857, some of the desperate people of India finally mutinied, and, excepting the African slave trade, nowhere has history recorded any more unnecessary, bestial, and ruthless human carnage than the British suppression of the non-white Indian people. Over 115 million African blacks, close to the 1930s population of the United States, were murdered or enslaved during the slave trade. And I read how, when the slave market was glutted, the cannibalistic white powers of Europe next carved up, as their colonies, the richest areas of the black continent. And Europe's chancelleries for the next century played a chess game of naked exploitation and power from Cape Horn to Cairo. 10 guards and the warden couldn't have torn me out of those books. Not even Elijah Muhammad could have been more eloquent than those books were in providing indisputable proof that the collective white man had acted like a devil in virtually every contact he had with the world's collective non-white man. I listen today to the radio and watch television and read the headlines about the collective white man's fear and tension concerning China. When the white man professes ignorance about why the Chinese hate him so, my mind can't help flashing back to what I read there in prison about how the blood forebears of this same white man raped China at a time when China was trusting and helpless. Those original white Christian traders sent into China millions of pounds of opium. By 1839, so many of the Chinese were addicts that China's desperate government destroyed 20,000 chests of opium. The first opium war was promptly declared by the white man. Imagine declaring war upon someone who objects to being narcotized. The Chinese were severely beaten with Chinese-invented gunpowder. The Treaty of Nanking made China pay the British white man for the destroyed opium, forced open China's major ports to British trade, forced China to abandon Hong Kong, fixed China's import tariff so low that cheap British articles soon flooded in, maiming China's industrial development. After a second opium war, the Tientsin treaties legalized the ravaging opium trade, legalized a British, French, American control of China's customs. China tried delaying that treaty's ratification. Peking was looted and burned. "Kill the foreign white devils" was the 1901 Chinese war cry in the Boxer Rebellion. Losing again, this time the Chinese were driven from Peking's choicest areas. The vicious, arrogant white man put up the famous signs, "Chinese and dogs not allowed." Red China, after World War II, closed its doors to the Western white world. Massive Chinese agricultural, scientific, and industrial efforts are described in a book that Life magazine recently published. Some observers inside Red China reported that the world never has known such a hate-white campaign as is now going on in this non-white country where present birth rates continuing. In 50 more years, Chinese will be half the Earth's population. And it seems that some Chinese chickens will soon come home to roost, with China's recent successful nuclear tests. Let us face reality. We can see in the United Nations a new world order being shaped along color lines, an alliance among the non-white nations. America's UN Ambassador Adlai Stevenson complained not long ago that in the United Nations, a skin game was being played. He was right. He was facing reality. A skin game is being played. But Ambassador Stevenson sounded like Jesse James accusing the marshal of carrying a gun. because who in the world's history ever has played a worse skin game than the white man? Mr. Muhammad, to whom I was writing daily, had no idea what a new world had opened up to me through my efforts to document his teachings and books. When I discovered philosophy, I tried to touch all the landmarks of philosophical development. Gradually, I read most of the old philosophers, Occidental and Oriental. The Oriental philosophers were the ones I came to prefer. Finally, my impression was that most Occidental philosophy had largely been borrowed from the Oriental thinkers. Socrates, for instance, traveled in Egypt. Some sources even say that Socrates was initiated into some of the Egyptian mysteries. Obviously, Socrates got some of his wisdom among the East's wise men. I've often reflected upon the new vistas that reading opened to me. I knew right there in prison that reading had changed forever the course of my life. As I see it today, the ability to read awoke inside me some long, dormant craving to be mentally alive. I certainly wasn't seeking any degree, the way a college confers a status symbol upon its students. My homemade education gave me, with every additional book that I read, a little bit more sensitivity to the deafness, dumbness, and blindness that was afflicting the black race in America. Not long ago, an English writer telephoned me from London asking questions. One was, "What's your alma mater?" I told him, "Books. You will never catch me with a free 15 minutes in which I'm not studying something I feel might be able to help the black man." Yesterday I spoke in London, and both ways on the plane across the Atlantic I was studying a document about how the United Nations proposes to ensure the human rights of the oppressed minorities of the world. The American black man is the world's most shameful case of minority oppression. What makes the black man think of himself as only an internal United States issue is just a catchphrase. Two words, civil rights. How is the black man going to get civil rights before first he wins his human rights? If the American black man will start thinking about his human rights and then start thinking of himself as part of one of the world's great peoples, he will see he has a case for the United Nations. I can't think of a better case. 400 years of black blood and sweat invested here in America, and the white man still has the black man begging for what every immigrant fresh off the ship can take for granted the minute he walks down the gangplank. But I'm digressing. I told the Englishman that my alma mater was books, a good library. Every time I catch a plane, I have with me a book that I want to read. And that's a lot of books these days. If I weren't out here every day battling the white man, I could spend the rest of my life reading, just satisfying my curiosity. Because you can hardly mention anything I'm not curious about. I don't think anybody ever got more out of going to prison than I did. In fact, prison enabled me to study far more intensively than I would have if my life had gone differently and I'd attended some college. I imagine that one of the biggest troubles with colleges is there are too many distractions, too much panty raiding, fraternities, and bula bula and all of that. Where else but in a prison could I have attacked my ignorance by being able to study intensely sometimes as much as 15 hours a day? Schopenhauer, Kant, Nietzsche. Naturally, I read all of those. I don't respect them. I'm just trying to remember some of those whose theories I soaked up in those years. These three, it said, laid the groundwork on which the fascist and Nazi philosophy was built. I don't respect them because it seems to me that most of their time was spent arguing about things that are not really important. They remind me of so many of the Negro intellectuals, so-called, with whom I've come in contact. They're always arguing about something useless. Spinoza impressed me for a while when I found out that he was black, a black Spanish Jew. The Jews excommunicated him because he advocated a pantheistic doctrine, something like the allness of God, or God in everything. The Jews read their burial services for Spinoza, meaning that he was dead as far as they were concerned. His family was run out of Spain. They ended up in Holland, I think. I'll tell you something. The whole stream of Western philosophy is now wound up in a cul-de-sac. The white man has perpetrated upon himself, as well as upon the black man, so gigantic a fraud that he's put himself into a crack. He did it through his elaborate, neurotic necessity to hide the black man's true role in history. And today the white man is faced head-on with what is happening on the black continent, Africa. Look at the artifacts being discovered there that are proving over and over again how the black man had great, fine, sensitive civilizations before the white man was out of the caves. Below the Sahara, in the places where most of America's Negroes' foreparents were kidnapped, There is being unearthed some of the finest craftsmanship, sculpture, and other objects that has ever been seen by modern man. Some of these things now are on view in such places as New York City's Museum of Modern Art. Gold work of such fine tolerance and workmanship that it has no rival. Ancient objects produced by black hands, refined by those black hands with results that no human hand today can equal. History has been so whitened by the white man that even the black professors have known little more than the most ignorant black man about the talents and rich civilizations and cultures of the black man of millenniums ago. I've lectured in Negro colleges, and some of these brainwashed black PhDs, with their suspenders dragging the ground with degrees, have run to the white man's newspapers calling me a black fanatic. Why, a lot of them are 50 years behind the times. If I were president of one of these black colleges, I'd hock the campus if I had to send a bunch of black students off digging in Africa for more, and more proof of the black race's historical greatness. The white man now is in Africa digging and searching. An African elephant can't stumble without falling on some white man with a shovel. Practically every week we read about some great new find from Africa's lost civilizations. All that's new is white science's attitude. The ancient civilizations of the black man have been buried on the black continent all the time. Here is an example. A British anthropologist named Dr. Lewis S.B. Leakey is displaying some fossil bones, a foot, part of a hand, some jaws, and skull fragments. On the basis of these, Dr. Leakey has said it's time to rewrite completely the history of man's origin. This species of man lived 1,818,036 years before Christ, and these bones were found in Tanganyika, in the Black Continent. It's a crime, the lie that has been told to generations of black men and white men both, little innocent black children born of parents who believed that their race had no history, little black children seeing before they could talk that their parents considered themselves inferior. Innocent black children growing up, living out their lives, dying of old age, and all of their lives ashamed of being black. But the truth is pouring out of the bag now. Two other areas of experience, which have been extremely formative in my life since prison, were first opened to me in the Norfolk prison colony. For one thing, I had my first experiences in opening the eyes of my brainwashed black brethren to some truths about the black race. And the other, when I'd read enough to know something, I began to enter the prison colony's weekly debating program, my baptism into public speaking. I have to admit a sad, shameful fact. I had so loved being around the white man that in prison I really disliked how Negro convicts stuck together so much. But when Mr. Muhammad's teachings reversed my attitude toward my black brothers, in my guilt and shame I began to catch every chance I could to recruit for Mr. Muhammad. You have to be careful, very careful, introducing the truth to the black man who has never previously heard the truth about himself, his own kind, and the white man. My brother Reginald had told me that all Muslims experience this in their recruiting for Mr. Muhammad. The black brother is so brainwashed that he may even be repelled when he first hears the truth. Reginald advised that the truth had to be dropped only a little bit at a time, and you had to wait a while to let it sink in before advancing the next step. I began first telling my black brother inmates about the glorious history of the black man, things they never dreamed. I told them the horrible slavery trade truths that they never knew. I would watch their faces when I told them about that, because the white man had completely erased the slave's past. A Negro in America can never know his true family name, or even what tribe he was descended from. The Mandingos, the Wolof, the Sera, the Fula, the Fanti, the Ashanti, or others. I told them that some slaves brought from Africa spoke Arabic and were Islamic in their religion. A lot of these black convicts still wouldn't believe it unless they could see that a white man had said it. So often, I would read to these brothers selected passages from white men's books. I'd explain to them that the real truth was known to some white men, the scholars, but there had been a conspiracy down through the generations to keep the truth from black men. I would keep close watch on how each one reacted. I always had to be careful. I never knew when some brainwashed black imp, some dyed-in-the-wool Uncle Tom, would nod at me and then go running to tell the white man. When one was ripe, and I could tell, then, away from the rest, I'd drop it on him. What Mr. Muhammad taught, the white man is the devil. That would shock many of them, until they started thinking about it. This is probably as big a single worry as the American prison system has today. The way the Muslim teachings circulated among all Negroes in the country are converting new Muslims among black men in prison, and black men are in prison in far greater numbers than their proportion in the population. The reason is that among all Negroes, the black convict is the most perfectly preconditioned to hear the words, "The white man is the devil." You tell that to any Negro. Except for those relatively few integration mad, so-called intellectuals, and those black men who are otherwise fat, happy, and deaf, dumb, and blinded with their crumbs from the white man's rich table, you have struck a nerve center in the American black man. He may take a day to react, a month, a year. He may never respond openly, but of one thing you can be sure, when he thinks about his own life, he's going to see where, to him personally, the white man sure has acted like a devil. And as I say, above all Negroes, the black prisoner. Here is a black man caged behind bars, probably for years, put there by the white man. Usually the convict comes from among those bottom-of-the-pile Negroes, the Negroes who through their entire lives have been kicked about, treated like children. Negroes who never met one white man who didn't either take something from them or do something to them. You let this caged-up black man start thinking, the same way I did when I first heard Elijah Muhammad's teachings. Let him start thinking how, with better breaks when he was young and ambitious, he might have been a lawyer, a doctor, a scientist, anything. You let this caged-up black man start realizing, as I did, how from the first landing of the first slave ship, the millions of black men in America have been like sheep in a den of wolves. That's why black prisoners become Muslims so fast when Elijah Muhammad's teachings filter into their cages by way of other Muslim convicts. The white man is the devil is a perfect echo of that black convict's lifelong experience. I've told how debating was a weekly event there at the Norfolk prison colony. My reading had my mind like steam under pressure. Some way I had to start telling the white man about himself to his face. I decided I could do this by putting my name down to debate. Standing up and speaking before an audience was a thing that throughout my previous life never would have crossed my mind. Out there in the streets, hustling, pushing dope and robbing, I could have had the dreams from a pound of hashish, and I'd never have dreamed anything so wild as that one day I would speak in coliseums and arenas, at the greatest American universities, and on radio and television programs, not to mention speaking all over Egypt and Africa and in England. But I will tell you that right there in the prison, debating, speaking to a crowd, was as exhilarating to me as the discovery of knowledge through reading had been. Standing up there, the faces looking up at me, the things in my head coming out of my mouth while my brain searched for the next best thing to follow what I was saying, and if I could sway them to my side by handling it right, then I had won the debate. Once my feet got wet, I was gone on debating. Whichever side of the selected subject was assigned to me, I'd track down and study everything I could find on it. I'd put myself in my opponent's place and decide how I'd try to win if I had the other side. And then I'd figure a way to knock down those points. And if there was any way in the world, I'd work into my speech the devilishness of the white man. Compulsory military training, or none. That's one good chance I got unexpectedly, I remember. My opponent flailed the air about the Ethiopians throwing rocks and spears at Italian airplanes, proving that compulsory military training was needed. I said the Ethiopians' black flesh had been spattered against trees by bombs the Pope in Rome had blessed, and the Ethiopians would have thrown even their bare bodies at the airplanes because they had seen that they were fighting the devil incarnate. They yelled foul, that I made the subject a race issue. I said it wasn't race, it was a historical fact, that they ought to go and read Pierre von Passen's Days of Our Years, and something not surprising to me, that book, right after the debate, disappeared from the prison library. It was right there in prison that I made up my mind to devote the rest of my life to telling the white man about himself, or die. In a debate about whether or not Homer had ever existed, I threw into those white faces the theory that Homer only symbolized how white Europeans kidnapped black Africans, then blinded them so that they could never get back to their own people. Homer and Omar and Moore, you see, are related terms. It's like saying Peter, Pedro, and Petra, all three of which mean rock. These blinded Moors, the Europeans taught to sing about the Europeans' glorious accomplishments. I made it clear that was the devilish white man's idea of kicks. Aesop's Fables, another case in point. Aesop was only the Greek name for an Ethiopian. Another hot debate I remember I was in had to do with the identity of Shakespeare. No color was involved there. I just got intrigued over the Shakespearean dilemma. The King James translation of the Bible is considered the greatest piece of literature in English. Its language supposedly represents the ultimate in using the King's English. Well, Shakespeare's language and the Bible's language are one and the same. They say that from 1604 to 1611, King James got poets to translate, to write the Bible. Well, if Shakespeare existed, he was then the top poet around. But Shakespeare is nowhere reported connected with the Bible. If he existed, why didn't King James use him? And if he did use him, why is it one of the world's best-kept secrets? I know that many say that Francis Bacon was Shakespeare. If that is true, why would Bacon have kept it secret? Bacon wasn't royalty. When royalty sometimes used the nom de plume because it was improper for royalty to be artistic or theatrical. What would Bacon have had to lose? Bacon, in fact, would have had everything to gain. In the prison debates, I argued for the theory that King James himself was the real poet who used the nom de plume Shakespeare. King James was brilliant. He was the greatest king who ever sat on the British throne. Who else among royalty in his time would have had the giant talent to write Shakespeare's works? It was he who poetically fixed the Bible, which in itself and its present King James version has enslaved the world. When my brother Reginald visited, I would talk to him about new evidence I found to document the Muslim teachings. In either volume 43 or 44 of the Harvard Classics, I read Milton's Paradise Lost. The devil, kicked out of paradise, was trying to regain possession. He was using the forces of Europe, personified by the popes, Charlemagne, Richard the Lionhearted, and other knights. I interpreted this to show that the Europeans were motivated and led by the devil, or the personification of the devil. So Milton and Mr. Elijah Muhammad were actually saying the same thing. I couldn't believe it when Reginald began to speak ill of Elijah Muhammad. I can't specify the exact things he said. There were more in the nature of implications against Mr. Muhammad. The pitch of Reginald's voice, or the way that Reginald looked, rather than what he said. It caught me totally unprepared. It threw me into a state of confusion. My blood brother, Reginald, in whom I had so much confidence, for whom I had so much respect, the one who had introduced me to the Nation of Islam. I couldn't believe it. And now Islam meant more to me than anything I ever had known in my life. Islam and Mr. Elijah Muhammad had changed my whole world. Reginald, I learned, had been suspended from the Nation of Islam by Elijah Muhammad. He had not practiced moral restraint. After he had learned the truth and had accepted the truth and the Muslim laws, Reginald was still carrying on improper relations with the then secretary of the New York Temple. Some other Muslim who learned of it had made charges against Reginald to Mr. Muhammad in Chicago, and Mr. Muhammad had suspended Reginald. When Reginald left, I was in torment. That night, finally, I wrote to Mr. Muhammad, trying to defend my brother, appealing for him. I told him what Reginald was to me, what my brother meant to me. I put the letter into the box for the prison censor. Then all the rest of that night, I prayed to Allah. I don't think anyone ever prayed more sincerely to Allah. I prayed for some kind of relief from my confusion. It was the next night, as I lay on my bed, I suddenly, with a start, became aware of a man sitting beside me in my chair. He had on a dark suit, I remember. I could see him as plainly as I see anyone I look at. He wasn't black, and he wasn't white. He was light brown-skinned, an Asiatic cast of countenance, and he had oily black hair. I looked right into his face. I didn't get frightened. I knew I wasn't dreaming. I couldn't move. I didn't speak. And he didn't.
I couldn't place him racially, other than I knew he was a non-European. I had no idea whatsoever who he was. He just sat there. Then suddenly as he'd come, he was gone. Soon Mr. Muhammad sent me a reply about Reginald. He wrote, "If you once believed in the truth, and now you're beginning to doubt the truth, you didn't believe the truth in the first place. What could make you doubt the truth other than your own weak self?" That struck me. Reginald was not leading the disciplined life of a Muslim. And I knew that Elijah Muhammad was right, and my blood brother was wrong, because right is right, and wrong is wrong. Little did I then realize the day would come when Elijah Muhammad would be accused by his own sons as being guilty of the same acts of immorality that he judged Reginald and so many others for. But at that time, all of the doubt and confusion in my mind was removed. All of the influence that my brother had wielded over me was broken. From that day on, as far as I'm concerned, everything that my brother Reginald has done is wrong. But Reginald kept visiting me. When he had been a Muslim, he had been immaculate in his attire. But now he wore things like a t-shirt, shabby-looking trousers, and sneakers. I could see him on the way down. When he spoke, I heard him coldly. But I would listen. He was my blood brother. Gradually, I saw the chastisement of Allah, what Christians would call the curse, come upon Reginald. Elijah Muhammad said that Allah was chastising Reginald, and that anyone who challenged Elijah Muhammad would be chastened by Allah. In Islam, we were taught that as long as one didn't know the truth, he lived in darkness. But once the truth was accepted and recognized, he lived in light. And whoever would then go against it would be punished by Allah. Mr. Muhammad taught that the five-pointed star stands for justice and also for the five senses of man. We were taught that Allah executes justice by working upon the five senses of those who rebel against his messenger or against his truth. We were taught that this was Allah's way of letting Muslims know his sufficiency to defend his messenger against any and all opposition, as long as the messenger himself didn't deviate from the path of truth. We were taught that Allah turned the minds of any defectors into a turmoil. I thought truly that it was Allah doing this to my brother. One letter, I think from my brother Filbert, told me that Reginald was with them in Detroit. I heard no more about Reginald until one day, weeks later, Ella visited me. She told me that Reginald was at her home in Roxbury, sleeping. Ella said she'd heard a knock. She'd gone to the door, and there was Reginald, looking terrible. Ella said she'd asked, "Where did you come from?" And Reginald had told her he came from Detroit. She said she asked him, "How did you get here?" And he told her, "I walked." I believe he had walked. I believed in Elijah Muhammad, and he had convinced us that Allah's chastisement upon Reginald's mind had taken away Reginald's ability to gauge distance and time. There is a dimension of time with which we are not familiar here in the West. Elijah Muhammad said that under Allah's chastisement, the five senses of a man can be so deranged by those whose mental powers are greater than his that in 5 minutes his hair can turn snow white, or he will walk 900 miles as he might walk 5 blocks. In prison, since I'd become a Muslim, I'd grown a beard. When Reginald visited me, he nervously moved about in his chair. He told me that each hair on my beard was a snake. Everywhere he saw snakes. He next began to believe that he was the messenger of Allah. Reginald went around in the streets of Roxbury, Ella reported to me, telling people that he had some divine power. He graduated from this to saying that he was Allah. He finally began saying he was greater than Allah. Authorities picked up Reginald, and he was put into an institution. They couldn't find what was wrong. They had no way to understand Allah's chastisement. Reginald was released. Then he was picked up again, and he was put into another institution. Reginald is in an institution now. I know where, but I won't say. I would not want to cause him any more trouble than he has already had. I believe today that it was written, it was meant, for Reginald to be used for one purpose only, as a bait, as a minnow to reach into the ocean of blackness where I was, to save me. I cannot understand it any other way. After Elijah Muhammad himself was later accused as a very immoral man, I came to believe that it wasn't a divine chastisement upon Reginald, but the pain he felt when his own family totally rejected him for Elijah Muhammad, And this hurt made Reginald turn insanely upon Elijah Muhammad. It's impossible to dream or to see or to have a vision of someone whom you never have seen before and to see him exactly as he is. To see someone and to see him exactly as he looks is to have a pre-vision. I would later come to believe that my pre-vision was of Master W.D. Fard, the Messiah, the one whom Elijah Muhammad said had appointed him, Elijah Muhammad, as his last messenger to the black people of North America. My last year in prison was spent back in the Charlestown prison. Even among the white inmates, the word had filtered around. Some of those brainwashed black convicts talked too much, and I know that the censors had reported on my mail. The Norfolk prison colony officials had become upset. They used as a reason for my transfer that I refused to take some kind of shots, an inoculation or something. The only thing that worried me was that I hadn't much time left before I would be eligible for parole board consideration. But I reasoned that they might look at my representing and spreading Islam in another way. Instead of keeping me in, they might want to get me out. I'd come to prison with 20/20 vision, but when I got sent back to Charlestown, I had read so much by the lights-out glow in my room at the Norfolk prison colony that I had astigmatism and the first pair of the eyeglasses that I've worn ever since. I had less maneuverability back in the much stricter Charlestown prison, but I found that a lot of Negroes attended a Bible class, and I went there. End of side 5.